hard road my poor hands have pulled. My poor feet have traveled this hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we roll, through deserts so hot and through mountains so cold. I've wandered all over your green growing land, wherever your crops are I'll lend you my hands. On the edge of your cities, you see me and then I come with the dust and I'm gone with a wind. California, Arizona, I've worked on your crop. Then northward up to Oregon to gather your hops. I dug beets from your ground. I've cut grapes from the vine. Set on your table that light sparkling wine. Green pastures of plenty. Dry desert ground, from the grand coulee dam where waters run down. Every state of this union, migrants have been. We come with the dust and we're gone. Always we ramble that river and I, all along your green valley I work till I die. Travel this road until death sets me free, 'cause pastures are plenty must all. I wandered all over your green growing land, wherever your crops are, I'll lend you my hands. On the edge of your cities you will see me, and then I've come with the dust and I'm gone.
And welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program is about the best democracy money can buy, and it starts with an interview of David Callahan, David K. Johnson, and Arianna Huffington, and they're interviewed by Francesca Rianan. They discuss how economic elites fight for control of the political elites. And then after that, Matt Taibbi is interviewed by Tavis Smiley. The Rolling Stones editor explains the inner workings of Wall Street and criticizes the U.S. bank bailout. And after that, Timothy McVeigh talks to Andrew Bacevich about military-industrial complex cutbacks. Will the proposed defense cuts reduce the total national security budget?
The real outrage here, though, is there's a complete separation of performance. Let me use John Snow as an example. John Snow ran the CSX Railroad before he was Treasury Secretary of the United States. As the stock of the company fell, his salary rose. And it rose enormously. I think he got $69 million. And he got a 69% increase in his pay as the stock fell about two-thirds. Exact opposite numbers. He walked away with an enormous fortune. Memory tells me it was about $200 million. He only worked the company for 25 years, but he got a pension for 44 years, and he got paid out in cash. And this is all the result of tax policy that allows this. By the way, after he was Treasury Secretary of the United States, Mr. Snow, who was one of the biggest proponents of free marketeerism, became head of a company called Cerebus. And it owns a company you probably never heard of, but you know about from the news, called IAP Worldwide. You remember all those trucks full of ice that never got to New Orleans but sat in places like Chattanooga and Atlanta idling?
You bet.
IAP Worldwide. You remember the mold and the awful repair job done on the quarters for wounded soldiers and their families at Walter Reed Army Hospital? IAP Worldwide. The very people who are at the top of our government promoting to us these policies of free market, get government out of the way, no regulation, are in fact the people who are profiteering off of this. The President of the United States, Dick Cheney, who set up hundreds, dozens if not hundreds of offshore entities so that Halliburton could avoid paying taxes, and then they got huge no-bid contracts for their KBR subsidiary in the war. Treasury Secretary John Snow and others. I mean, this is it's just incredible to me that the American public is not revulsed by these scandals.
Johnson says the reason for this is, just after our interview, the TARP bailout bill passed. That was under the Bush administration. Since then, we've seen an anemic financial reform under Obama that many critics, including Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman, have said will do little to prevent the need for future Wall Street bailouts. I asked David K. Johnston what he would have asked for if he were Treasury Secretary.
Number one, we need to regulate banks. And you notice Goldman Sachs has announced today, along with Morgan Stanley, that they're going to convert into bank holding companies, which will make them subject to regulation by the federal government. Of course, if we don't hire enough bank examiners and regulators and tell them to go do their jobs, it's a hollow reform.
Now, in terms of what your book says, Free Lunch, and we're talking with David K. Johnston, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, formerly of the New York Times. His book is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with a Bill. Going forward, what might be, if you had one recommendation to make that might begin to turn the pendulum the other way, to begin to redress this grievous situation, what would it be?
Are you talking about Wall Street here?
Wall Street, and more generally, actually, this whole situation of corporate socialism, how to make the system fairer for American citizens in general, for the bulk of us?
Well, changes like this occur because there are broad cultural changes in the marketplace. You know, Ronald Reagan started, it was starting a little bit before him, but he got the ball really going with his assertions that, you know, big government was the problem, et cetera. And so the fundamental thing we have to do is get people informed so that we can change the culture. And here are two fundamental ways to do that. I think people ought to be asking this question every time they read about a tax forgiveness or a subsidy or some benefit to some company for a new investment they're going to make. If it's a sound investment, the market will make it. If it's not a sound investment, why should the state's coercive power to force you to pay taxes at the point of a barrel of a gun be used to make you subsidize an unsound investment? So that's the first one. If it's a sound investment, the market will make it. If it's not a sound investment, why should you be forced into subsidizing that investment? The second one is we need to stop discussing taxes only in terms of the share of income taxes paid by the wealthiest Americans. We need to look at the total burden of taxes. It turns out that, for example, in New York State, thought of by many people as one of the more progressive states, that the wealthy pay a smaller share of their income to the state than the poor. In Alabama, the wealthiest citizens pay less than half as much of their income to the state as the poor. And we need to fundamentally address this issue and get off this notion that taxes are a way of punishing productive people. taxes have a moral basis. It's come down to us for 2,500 years from the Athenians. It is the oldest and most conservative principle in Western civilization, and that is you cannot become wealthy without the existence of a civilization, and the wealthier you manage to become, the greater your moral duty to maintain that civilization that made your wealth possible. That's the moral principle that gave birth to democracy, and to the extent that we are ignoring that, and we're instead giving unlimited, unreviewable power to the government to spend our tax dollars, that we are taxing the poor and the middle class to literally give money to the richest people in America, we are giving up democracy.
Well, David K. Johnston, it's been a pleasure talking with you about your book, Free Lunch, and about the situation that is right now going on that is such a prime example of the things you talk about in your book.
Thank you, Francesca.
David K. Johnston is a former investigative journalist for the New York Times. He's the author of Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal. I spoke to him in 2008. You can hear the entire interview by going to writersvoice.net/archives. With high unemployment, a tsunami of housing foreclosures, health insurance premiums going through the roof, and college education becoming unaffordable for the middle class, is America becoming a third world country? That's what my next guest, Arianna Huffington, says in her new book, Third World America: How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. Huffington took a few minutes out of her insanely busy book tour schedule to talk with me by cell phone from New York City. I apologize for the poor quality audio, but if you want to get the whole scoop, go out and get her highly readable and informative book. You know, your terrific book, Third World America, I finished it yesterday and went on to read the New York Times and saw right on the front page there, employment picture dims as government cuts back. And it was on the same page as the foreclosure fraud. Is this some of what you talk about Third World America?
So I chose this title, which obviously is very provocative and jarring in terms of how we see America, because I wanted to sound the alarm. I wanted us to pay attention while we could still course correct. And that's why I chose this title. Obviously, we're not third world America yet, but if we don't course correct, if we don't make fundamental changes, we will be.
And how did we get to this pass?
How did we get here?
Yes.
It's really been over 30 years of public policy that has undermined the middle class. You know, we went from a country that makes things to a country that makes things up. You know, that is all about credit default swaps and a casino mentality on Wall Street and excessive risks and credit card companies and mortgage companies hiding all sorts of tricks and traps in their contracts that would undermine the middle class. And all that ended up basically with the undermining of the American dream, because the middle class is at the heart of the foundation of America.
And why
and
is that?
It is because we basically have this possibility, this sense of possibility that's inherent in the American dream. The idea that if you work hard and play by the rules, you will be able to do well and your children will be able to do better still. This upward mobility that is such a big part of the middle class. And now, instead of upward mobility, we have downward mobility. We have 100 million people who are worse off now than their parents were at a similar age.
You know, you have some wonderful stories. Well, they're sad stories, but some very moving stories in your book, Third World America. If you could pick one to tell our listeners right now, people that you heard about, people who contacted you, people you've talked with who show in their lives this betrayal of the middle class, what would that story be?
Can I pick two? Because one of them is the story I use as the first story in the book, Dean Blackburn, who was brought up by a single mom, a teacher in Minneapolis. He worked hard. He got into Yale. He worked then in technology jobs for 17 years, and then he lost his job 2 years ago and has not been able to find another job. And I pick Dean up as an example because he's an educated guy. His job is in high-tech jobs that's supposed to be doing so well, and yet here he is, without a job, not being able to take care of his family. Then you have the story of Brenda Carter, with whom I met actually yesterday in Atlanta, and she had a good job in human resources for 11 years, lost her job, and went into a deep depression, and then fortunately was able to tap into her own strength and resilience and began to rebuild her life, took a real estate license course, started cooking praline candies at home and selling them online to be able to make ends meet. And that's the story of so many people in America who stay resilient, try to make ends meet, but it's getting harder and harder, and I don't see how we are going to turn it around.
The stimulus. Obama did a stimulus. We're still stuck at 10% with unemployment. Obama says it takes time, that we should have patience. What's your thought on that?
You know, of course it takes time, but we haven't seen the same urgency that was put to helping Wall Street. We haven't seen the same urgency around Main Street, and that's what I'm really saying. Can we do the same thing we did in order to bail out Wall Street, when everybody came together and threw everything against the wall and we saved Wall Street? Now we need to do the same around jobs. You know, we need to have a payroll tax holiday. We need to have major infrastructure projects that will really create jobs and also improve our bridges and our dams and our roads that desperately need improving.
You know, Obama came in promising a green economy, a transition to green jobs. There was a report that was done for the Center for American Progress that said that, you know, we could green job our way out of this mess. And yet it doesn't seem that a whole lot is going into that kind of green infrastructure. Do you have any idea why not? And how can we get that going?
Yes, I totally agree with that. I think that this would be an opportunity to actually create the economy of the 21st century, because, you know, we can't really have the same economy that we had in the 20th century that was based on consumption, and where we were basically overtaken by other countries and other industries. And clearly the country that's going to do the most innovation around green technologies will own the 21st century.
You talk about another problem in the book. You know, the Republicans are saying that our problem is really that we have too much debt. And you say the debt problem is real. I mean, some other economists like Paul Krugman are saying, you know, we need to do more deficit spending. And the Republicans are saying we can't increase the deficit. What's your thought on this? What would you like to tell people about our debt problems and how we really should be tackling them?
Well, obviously the deficit is a big problem, but, you know, if we don't grow our economy, we will never be able to solve the deficit problem. We need to grow our economy, and that's the absolute highest priority. And there are many ways we can do that. We just need the political will.
Okay, well, that's the big phrase, the political will. We see the Tea Party movement. We've just heard from Jane Mayer in The New Yorker that it's really being funded by some of the biggest billionaires in the world. But how are we going to build the political will for the kind of program you're talking about that can save the middle class?
Well, I feel that it's a question of creating a movement that will change the wind. You know, politicians put their fingers up in the wind and see which way it's blowing. We need to make sure it's blowing in the right direction. I divide my solutions chapter, which is the fifth chapter, into two parts. The first part is about government solutions, which of course are critical. And the second part is about what we can do right now, working on government to do its part, which is absolutely imperative if we're going to turn things around.
And how are we going to do that?
obviously, it's a question of making sure that we participate in our democracy, that we pressure our elected officials to do the right thing, that we elect the people who are most committed to bring a sense of urgency to our problems, and at the same time, that we work hard in our own communities right now, even while we're waiting for government to do the right thing. And, you know, I would love to invite your listeners and you to come to the Third World America section of the Huffington Post, where we have people sharing their stories, bearing witness to what's happening. We have an interactive map, and people can go there and you put a star for each story around the country. And I think bearing witness and sharing stories and sharing each other's burdens, while doing things like building our financial literacy, moving our money from big banks, these are all things that we can do right now while we are also pressuring our elected officials for government to do the right thing.
Arianna Huffington, I know you have our time grows short. I wanted to ask you one last question, and that's more of a personal one, because you made the journey that now you are hoping and we are asking so many Americans to make themselves, and that is the journey from a conservative politics to a progressive politics. What was the critical thing that moved you? How did you change?
You know, some of the issues that we're talking about today, what's happening to the middle class, what's happening to the poorest Americans, were issues that have always preoccupied me, whether I was a Republican or now. What changed was my understanding of the role of government. I saw very clearly that we could never solve the problems we are facing without the raw power of government appropriations. But at the same time, I believe profoundly that we need individuals and the private sector to step up to the plate and do our part to turn lives and communities around.
Arianna Huffington speaking to us by cell phone from New York City on book tour about her latest book, Third World America. Huffington is the founder of the progressive blog Huffington Post. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt of the book and for a link to the Third World America website.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane, and Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world, serve its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up an ox, beat grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Fight down. High wire and a fire representing seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Left to us are coming in a hurry with the fury speed. My team reporters babble Trump, Kevin Kraft, look at that, no plane, fine, then, overflow, population common food, but it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, world serves its own needs, listen to your heart, bleed, dummy with the rapture and the reverend and the right, right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam, fight, bright, light, feeling, pretty sight,
it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world. Slice and burn, return, listen to yourself, churn. Lock it in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive, incinerate, light a candle, light a motor, step down, watching heel, crush, crush, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
Yeah. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
And now for something completely different.